case for the October calendar, 98-3485 CR, State v. Hodgson? Agent. Okay, thank you. And Jennifer Nashhold, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin. Nashhold.
Thank you. May it please the court, I am Assistant Attorney General Jennifer Nashhold, and I represent the state of Wisconsin in this matter. I'd like to begin today by emphasizing three very brief but very significant facts relating to the search conducted in this case. First, Supervisor Hammes intended to conduct a probation search all along, even prior to speaking with Investigator Poppenfuss or Agent Sealer. Second, there was never an abandonment of probation goals. There was only a three-week delay in taking action on the potential probation violation. Three, Supervisor Hammes requested law enforcement assistance in conducting the probation search, not vice versa. These facts are important when analyzing the standards or factors in determining whether this was a lawful probation search or an unlawful police search. The case site, the state cites many cases in its brief showing various standards for determining whether a probation or parole agent acts as a stalking horse for police. What can be gleaned from these cases is that there are two very important factors that courts have considered. First, whether law enforcement requests the search or whether it was initiated by the probation agent, and second, whether the agent in conducting the search has legitimate objectives of the probation system. Here, these facts show that these standards are met. First of all, there was no request to search by law enforcement in this case. It was Hammy's suggestion, as I stated, that the search take place. Moreover, there was a legitimate probation interest here. The defendant had been on probation for drug offenses. He had been on probation between 2 to 3 years. And Supervisor Hammes had information that he had violated the terms of his probation by using or trafficking in drugs. He, therefore, had a legitimate probationary purpose in ascertaining whether this probationer was violating the terms of his probation. The fact that he waited for 3 weeks does not diminish the fact that he had these legitimate probationary interests. This three-week delay, I think, was really significant to both the trial court and the Court of Appeals. I think that is the factor that the court really had problems with, the courts, both courts. But I'd like to point out, as I did in my brief, that there's no authority suggesting that a probation agent must immediately conduct a probation search once he or she has grounds to do so. As testified to by Supervisor Hammes in this case, he said, and I quote, "Frequently we'll allow law enforcement to work their case before we take some action." A ruling in the defendant's favor in this case would very much reshape the relationship between law enforcement and probation and parole. One can imagine a scenario in a busy county, for example, where a probation agent looks at a file, sees that someone is potentially violating the terms of his or her probation, as here, with potential drug dealing or something, and lets that file sit for a while because of other more important potential violations or business at hand.
Well, there seems to be no question in this record, but correct me if I'm incorrect, that Hammes held off because of police interest, that in fact he was prepared to conduct a probation search, and probably the best time to conduct the probation search was immediately, but he held off due to police interest.
Yes, he stated that he did not want to interfere with the investigation that police were conducting. My point in bringing up whether probation might have other interests that are more pressing is just that the defense asks you to rule that whenever a probationer has, or I'm sorry, a probation agent has reasonable grounds to believe that a probationer is in violation of the terms of his or her probation, that immediate action must take place. And the state requests that that not be the law, whether it's because a probation or parole agent takes a reasonable amount of time to let, as happened here, law enforcement work its case, or whether there are other reasons that the agent did not take immediate action. This was a reasonable amount of time to accommodate an investigation that was ongoing. And also, I'd like to point out that when that conversation between Agent Sealer and Mr. Hammes took place, they didn't immediately ask for 3 weeks. They said 1, 2, 3 weeks. It wasn't clear how long it would be. They did have contact again and to give an update on the investigation. And at that point, Hammes was informed that there was that the investigation was still underway.
Is there any indication in the record that at the time Hammes was at the first point when he wanted to conduct the probation search, that he was requesting police officer assistance?
No, there, as far as I know, there's nothing in the record to indicate that at that time he was saying, I want to conduct this search and I would like your assistance. It was only on September 24th that he requested law enforcement assistance.
Counsel, I want to look at certain statements made in the Court of Appeals opinion characterizing the trial court opinion and also the trial court opinion to see if you think that these are findings of fact. There are two on split opinion page 5, appendix 105, that I want to ask you about. One follows the other, and they're set forth on that page 5, 105, in the bottom paragraph. The second sentence of that bottom paragraph, and let me stop to see if you have located where I am.
The court determined that probation supervisor.
Yes. That sentence reads, the court determined that probation supervisor Hammes, quote, acted at the behest of law enforcement. Counsel, is that a factual determination, or historical factual determination of the trial court?
I think that's a similar question as the one that was raised in the briefs as to whether law enforcement dictated the timing of the search. I think that this falls more on the side of a characterization of the evidentiary or historical facts more than just a statement of the facts.
Well, is this a factual finding of the court upon which we can rely?
I think that if it had said that Hammes acted at the request of law enforcement to delay the search for 3 weeks, that would be a factual finding. But this strikes me more as a conclusion of law that this was an agent acting as a stalking horse, that
well,
this agent had changed hats.
Let me go to the actual trial court opinion. Page 8 of these slip opinion, 130 of the appendix. And I want to address that very point. I'm looking at the last sentence on the top paragraph. This is the trial court's decision, and it determined that, quote,
law enforcement determined first when the search would not take place, and after their own investigation faltered, determined when the search could take place. Is that a factual finding of the court?
I don't believe that that is an objective finding of fact, because as I stated in my brief, it was Hammes' decision, once he spoke with his supervisor, Mike Liu, to postpone a search that he intended to make.
Counsel, let me... You know, it seems to me arguably, you know, who knows, but it seems to me arguably what you are advancing is your interpretation of the facts. And your understanding of the facts, based on the record, and I'm not saying that they're wrong, but in contrast to the trial court's interpretation of the facts. And why should we accept your interpretation of the facts over the trial court's statement that I read on page 8, that law enforcement determined when the search would not take place, and after their own investigation faltered, determined when the search could take place?
Because it was Hammes that decided when the search could take place, not law enforcement. The court is drawing an inference, is analyzing the bare facts. The bare fact is that law enforcement informed Hammes that their investigation had ended, that there was no reason to further delay the search. And so that does not lead to this conclusion that that means that they then determined that the search was going to take place.
But a trial court is not a parrot. The trial court's findings cannot be limited to solely parroting verbatim what the witnesses said. Rather, the trial court, based on the testimony and the reasonable inference therefrom, can make findings. And
I'm not sure that I can answer your question more thoroughly than just to state that this is more of a conclusion based on the fact that they called him and they said to Mr. Hammes, we're done with our investigation. And I think that it is more of a characterization, just like the characterization that they dictated the timing of the search, than just a mere factual finding.
We would have in some circumstances, and I think maybe this, that there's contrasting testimony.
Mm-hmm.
I did one saying law enforcement did control some of the mode and method or timing of the search. And then we have someone else testifying as contrary to that. I mean, that's the bread and butter of a trial court judge, hearing one side of the facts and the other side saying, no, we didn't control it. And then the trial court judge says, well, one side says you did, one side says you didn't. That got to make a finding. And so here I'm going to find that law enforcement did determine when first the search would not take place, and law enforcement did determine that based on this competing factual recitation. I got to make a finding.
Well, you mentioned mode and method. Had there been a finding, for example, that the officers participated in the search and that they were opening closets, they were directing the search in this case in some way, that would strike me as a pure factual finding. What did they do? What actions did they take when they were there with the probation agents? Did they open this closet? Did they open that drawer? Did they tell the agents where to go? And that, I would submit, is a purely factual finding. But here, it's just based on the fact that Hammes decided that he would postpone a search by 3 weeks, and then after realizing that there was no reason to further postpone the search, he then proceeded.
It was an indeterminate time that he was postponing. As it happened, it wasn't until the police officers told him that he can go ahead because they couldn't find anything. He didn't say, okay, I'll give you 3 weeks.
Absolutely. My reading of the record is that he asked for 1, 2, 3 weeks, that it was going to be a short period of time that he was being requested to delay a search that he could have conducted at that time. There's no indication, though, that this was an inordinate amount of time, and what we're left with at the time of the trial court's hearing is that it was 3 weeks. And so the question here is that a reasonable amount of time to delay a search under the circumstances of this case? And I'd like to point out, too, that this is not the kind of violation where time is necessarily of the essence. It's not a violation. The probation agent did not have information, for example, that he had violated the terms of his probation by visiting an ex-wife who he was convicted of battering, or that he was engaged in the process right then of sexually assaulting someone, or was just leaving the scene of a murder or an armed robbery or something. This was a situation where the probation agents had information that he was potentially dealing and using drugs, and that's not a situation that's likely to change overnight. This is a situation that is more likely to be an ongoing activity, and I think it was a very reasonable judgment call on behalf of Mr. Hamis's part to delay it for 3 weeks and then to go ahead and search after 3 weeks. And I pointed out in my brief, and the trial court was concerned with this too, that there may be circumstances where there's an allegation that a defendant has violated a minor term of probation or had committed a rather petty offense, but the officers are engaged in investigating a far more serious offense. And does this court want to then say that whenever there are grounds to either conduct a search or to take any activity, a urinalysis or to detain the probationer, that the agent must do so right then and thereby jeopardize an investigation that's taking place? And the trial court was concerned with this too.
How many people not from probation or parole, not from corrections, went with the agent to the domicile?
Three.
Why three? Now, obviously, sometimes they'll take one, maybe two, maybe three, if there's a concept that they may be in danger, right?
Right.
Is there any showing in this record that he was in any danger?
Well, this court and the Court of Appeals has recognized that there often is a link between drugs and weapons. Here he was accused of dealing crack cocaine, not an insubstantial type of drug. And I'd like to point out, too, that in Griffin, it was the same amount of officers. It was three officers and two probation agents. I think I misstated that in my brief and said it was only one probation agent. It was two people from probation and three officers, the same amount as here. And I don't think that unless it's, you know, some overwhelming force, perhaps, a SWAT team or something.
How long have they had this man under probation?
Approximately 2.5 years.
Any indication of weapons?
Not that I'm aware of.
Was there anything in his record on arrest that the probation officer would have known, parole officer would have known, that showed weapons?
I don't know about his record. I'm not sure what the probation agent knew.
Anything in the 2.5 years that showed that he fights or would resist?
As I say, I'm not familiar with his complete record.
So there's nothing here that would indicate that, other than that there are drugs, which the U.S. Supreme Court has said that's not enough to show that there's weapons.
Right? Right. It's not enough, but it is a factor, and this court has recognized that time and time again. And
right. It got reversed, at least on one time, of recognizing that. So that's a factor, but there's nothing else here that's a factor. So now he takes three people. Why does he take three people?
Well, I think three people is a reasonable amount, considering that there
are two... Is it a large apartment or house?
I don't know that that's in the record. But there are two people, as it turns out, at the residence, the defendant and another woman. There are two probation agents, and the probation agents do not have the type of training in protecting themselves, securing the premises that law enforcement does.
The probation officers visit the homes of their probationers, don't they? Supposed to?
Yes.
Okay. And when they're there, can they search if they have reasonable suspicion that there's something?
If they have reasonable grounds to do so.
Okay, so now, not every time that they go to a house with reasonable suspicion do they take three officers, two probationer officers and three others, right?
Not every time. This was a planned search. This was a situation where the information that was received by probation and parole was significant. And...
The question is, who was it planned by, Ms. Nashel? That's the question, isn't it?
Right. And the operating manual for probation and parole specifically states that they should take law enforcement along. And there's nothing in that manual that says it has to be one, that it has to be the same amount of probation officers as law enforcement. And this court should just look at what is reasonable in this case. And to have three law enforcement people along with two probation agents is not unreasonable. They were involved in securing the premises and ensuring the safety of these agents.
If that's the manual, maybe under the law of Wisconsin, every search by the probation officers that they take law enforcement officers is a search by law enforcement officers.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
I'm saying that if the rule in Wisconsin is that a probation officer should take along law enforcement when they're doing a search, why don't we just say that it's all law enforcement and we don't have to break down this business of whose search is it? I mean, isn't it silly? It's just silly.
I don't think it's silly. I think that there should be a lower standard. This person has been given a conditional liberty and he's serving probation in lieu of prison, and so therefore the probation officer should have a lower threshold for determining when to go in there.
Once he brings the cops, that's it.
But they should be able to ensure their safety, unless we want all probation officers to be trained law enforcement people. How are they supposed to ensure their safety? How are they supposed to secure the premises? Their training is nowhere near what a law enforcement agent has for the most part.
And how are we or any court supposed to determine on facts like this whose search it is? I mean, it's everybody's search.
Well, I think looking at the Ninth Circuit cases, I actually think that the dissent was onto something in articulating this standard, that it is only when probation agents are acting solely as instrumentalities of law enforcement that they are stalking horses. If that is too extreme for this court, then I would ask that it perhaps employ factors as it does in analyzing curtilage and come up with a set of factors, including would this search have taken place but for a request on the part of law enforcement? Was there a request on the part of law enforcement, or was this initiated by probation and parole?
And if I might interrupt for a minute, what were the three persons that were non-probation agents or officers doing when the search was being conducted by the two probation agents?
I believe that Investigator Poppenfuss basically stuck with Agent Hammes as he was going through the apartment. Agent Sealer...
When you say stuck with him, does that mean that he was assisting in searching, or was he just there?
He was there, I believe, following Agent Hammes as he went into the bedroom, found the 117 Percocet tablets, as, and I believe he followed him to the garage where the duffel bag with the marijuana was. I know that Agent Seeler also placed the handcuffs on the defendant at the instruction of Agent Hammies once he was directed to do so by Agent Hammies, and that's another reason to have law enforcement there, is to conduct the arrest. And Agent Thalen was initially involved. He was with Probation Agent Johnson in watching. He was outside. He did not go to the door initially. He was outside making sure no one came in or out of the house.
Are these the three law enforcement officers the same law enforcement officers who were engaged in the criminal investigation and unable to come up with probable cause to get a warrant?
Yes, they were, at least the agents from DNE. But in looking at the cases cited by both parties in the briefs, this is not uncommon, and there's no rule that says that it has to be different agents that you bring along on a search, different law enforcement officers.
Was the fact that before they went with the agent on the search, before they did that, they called the district attorney and told the district attorney that they were going on this probation, they were going on the search with the probation officer. Is that dispositive of all at all?
I don't think it should be. It doesn't go to the issue of whether this was initiated by probation or by law enforcement, and it doesn't go to the issue of whether Hammies had a legitimate probation interest, and he clearly did.
Wasn't that one of the things on page 9 of the trial court's opinion that the trial court relied upon, not only the timing, but there was the same investigation officials who were unable to get probable cause in their own investigation that they called the DA, and that Hammes' inability at the hearing on the motion to recall if he had personally requested the assistance of DNA officers in search also support the findings? So wasn't that something that he...
Those were factors that the court relied on, and the state disagrees that those should bear in any way on this issue, because what law enforcement does with its own law enforcement objectives should not affect the question of whether Hammes was... whether he was a stalking horse or whether he conducted a lawful probation search. And as I stated in that, or cited in that Hill case from Arizona, the fact that police have an independent motive for searching should not undermine an otherwise valid search. I'm sure that the officers were happy that they found drugs in the defendant's premises and that they had a case, but that does not mean that Hammes was not acting under his lawful authority as a probation officer and that he conducted a lawful probation search. There was nothing untoward about this, and I would ask the court to reverse the Court of Appeals decision.
De novo?
De novo?
De novo, yeah. Interpretation?
Absolutely. On the ultimate issue of whether this was a stalking horse situation or not, I think that that issue, it should be reviewed de novo. That's consistent with this court's precedent.
Thank you.
Chief?
Yes, Justice Brasser.
There is a statement in the circuit judge's opinion. Soon thereafter, Hightire, who is the agent, ordered a urinalysis for, and I can't pronounce that name, Hacek. What happened with that urinalysis?
As Hammes testified, the urinalysis wasn't done during that three-week period. And then, of course, after the arrest, there was no reason to do the urinalysis.
When it was ordered, what does it mean, ordered? Was there contact between the agent and the defendant?
The agent and the defendant? I don't believe so, but I'm not sure, and the record doesn't indicate what exactly ordered entails. So I don't know whether any information went to the defendant. It doesn't seem like it from the record. It seems like that Hightire had made a decision to conduct a urinalysis.
Thank you. Mr. Rosen, representing Mr. Hacek.
Good afternoon. I'm Bruce Rosen. I represent Charles Hacek, the defendant. 14 years ago when this court rendered a decision in Griffin, I think the fact situation before this court was predictable. That not only was it constitutionally affirmed that we're carving out an exception to the Fourth Amendment, probation agents can search without warrants, a narrow exception, provided they don't act as stalking horses. I would respectfully submit the Haycheck situation is the only way the stalking horse could arise. Let me give three situations. One, law enforcement is the source of the information, which is ambiguous in this record. But law enforcement calls a probation officer and says, we have heard Mr. Haycheck is involved in the distribution and or use of drugs. We think you ought to search. The agent says, I haven't heard a thing. He's been compliant. He's followed all the rules. And the agent says, our information's reliable. The probation agent says, well, then fine. We're going to go do a home visit. I submit that's cooperation. That's law enforcement getting the probation officer to do what he is obligated to do. Go search. Maybe he had no reason. That's what you decided in Flakes.
Is that the anonymous tip? You're saying that the tip to the agent came from law enforcement?
The tip originally came via a county in northern Wisconsin to Milwaukee, designated anonymous. During Seeler's testimony, he indicated that the informant was a known informant, was reliable. So there's ambiguity as to who the informant was working for and when, but let's say it was anonymous, hypothetically. In that first situation, of course probation should go search. That's why they work ostensibly in concert. The second situation it could arise in is probation is contacted by Justice Department. We understand you're going to do a probation search. We don't want you to do it. This is an informant for us. This is a valuable asset. Please don't do it. In that case, if probation acquiesces, there would never be a case or controversy. There would be never anything to argue about as an agent. The only way stalking horse can ever arise is in this situation where they are asked to abandon all responsibilities of probation and parole. The urinalysis that the justice pointed out was requested by Milwaukee. Hightower faxed back to La Crosse. And part of the reason it was so difficult to reconstruct what happened is nobody had notes, which the court thought was peculiar. In Hamas's file, there's no notes, no chronology, no log of any contact with law enforcement concerning this case. The mirror side of that, Justice Department, by coincidence, or serendipity, I think was the court's phrase, they also had no notes. So we're forced to reconstruct what happened. Hightower faxed back a request that based on this information, we want you to do two things. Immediately do a urinalysis of Mr. Haycheck. Two, verify whether or not this anonymous tip is legitimate and is reasonable suspicion to go to a home visit.
Mr. Rosen, I thought I understood you to say that the Department of Justice contacted Mr. Hamas.
Correct.
That's not what I read in the circuit judge's opinion.
Initially, it was my understanding Hamas contacted Poppenfuss from the La Crosse Police Department, informed him in this effort to verify this tip. He said, we've heard the same thing. That was sufficient verification. As a result, as best we're able to reconstruct, Poppenfuss, not Hamas, was aware that state justice was doing an investigation and they contacted Hamas. And that's where the discrepancies, at least as I recall it, but I'll defer to the record, but that's where the discrepancies start.
Page 2 of Judge Montalban's opinion, he says, in verifying the information contained in the file, Hamas contacted Special Agent Jim Seiler of the Wisconsin Department of Justice. I infer from that that it's Mr. Hamas who's the contact.
Okay, I'll defer to the record. But what we're presented with here is the logical conclusion to Griffin. What is a stalking horse? How are we going to know it when we see it? And how are we going to judge those who claim to have seen it? I would submit, contrary to what the state has argued, that a stalking horse is a search where none of the policy of Griffin has been followed. Griffin, this exception that was carved out, was based on time, expediency, that because of the volatility of probation, we need to determine, as soon as practicable, whether or not there is compliance, that we don't think it is appropriate to require either a judicial warrant, an administrative law warrant, or anything else because of the delay. We need to create a deterrent effect and have consequences to violation. Well, this is the mere image of that. Time is their enemy. Because had he gone, and I would concede, as I think we conceded in the trial court, on August 19th, this isn't 3 weeks, it's 5 weeks, on August 19th, when the tip came in, had an agent gone to Mr. Haycheck's residence, I believe there's reasonable suspicion based on the current status of the law. An anonymous tip, sufficiently detailed, appears to be plausible or credible. Whatever verified means, they contacted law enforcement, that was verified. On August 19th, I would submit there was reasonable suspicion. Going to how are we going to know this horse, now that we've set what I'm proposing, is a standard of Griffin that if none of the policy, I mean, if you vote, or should the case come out affirming the two previous courts, this is just telling probation, do your job. Do your searches. We're not hampering them. We're encouraging you to do it. At some point, the road between law enforcement and probation can travel quite a distance together. But at some point, there are different objectives. On the left is probation and parole, the responsibility to supervise, to protect the public. And it's interesting, the state argues there was no indication of dangerousness, and this isn't the kind of case that would require immediate action. At the trial court, we all took different positions, sort of like being a respondent. But we all took different positions. I asked Thomas, in your opinion, was the conduct engaged in by Mr. Haycheck dangerous? Well, yeah, I consider crack cocaine dangerous. Potentially life-threatening. This is pretty serious stuff. Yeah. When I pointed out 328.22, which was the conclusion of that Roger Lang, Paula McCormick awful mess here in Madison, where an agent didn't respond immediately to allegations of dangerousness, we passed a rule that requires, where there is an allegation of dangerous conduct, act immediately. And when then confronted with the question, I would say, well, in that context, I didn't consider it dangerous because he, I would submit, saw that we were going down a path that one of the litmus tests, and the court deferred that decision as to whether we had met our burden to show they had failed to comply with taking somebody that, based on the record, might be dangerous in order to defer to law enforcement. But that would have been one of the litmus tests, that here you say it's dangerous, you're mandated immediately to do a search, you don't do a search, it's another piece in the puzzle. There is no one fact that here is determinative, as the court said, it was like a mosaic. And that's why we defer to trial courts. I mean, the transcript really doesn't show the nuances of the pregnant pauses, the smirks, when Agent Sealer is asked, did you have occasion to tell Mr. Haycheck that, in fact, you don't need a warrant? You're with probation. There's no way to get that sense, and that's why there's a deference to trial courts, to get a sense of credibility.
Plausible. Mr. Rosen.
Yes.
My understanding of the facts in this case is that after the probation agents conducted their search, that then the officers, the law enforcement officers, applied for and were granted a search warrant, and that they went back to the home and searched based on that warrant. How does that fit into all of this in your opinion? Is that significant one way or the other?
It is significant because I believe the court has not yet found, but I read the trial court's ruling. The search warrant was based on observations made by law enforcement at the time of this purported probation search. If in fact it was not a probation search and it's this elusive stalking horse, then it would be fruit of the poison tree.
Well, isn't the argument the other way, that if this was really a law enforcement search, why didn't they search? Why would they then go and apply for and get a search warrant and conduct a search based on that warrant?
There were many ambiguities in the record as to how, first of all, it was ambiguous between Hamas and Sealer as to exactly what they were told. We can't make a case. We can't get probable cause. Papenfuss said the case is closed. Or one could argue the reasonable inference is the conversation went, we checked Haycheck out. We can't come up with anything. He's clean.
How
Which
is
was
that?
One of our arguments in the brief, that if there was reasonable suspicion in August to do it, not only did he abandon any legitimate, plausible claim that he's fulfilling probation and parole, but there was no refreshed visitation to reasonable suspicion, sort of like an anticipatory search warrant, where now the act doesn't occur. You had probable cause, but the ultimate act doesn't occur. We need to revisit it. There is now an intervening fact. And the intervening fact is State Justice Department has had Mr. Haycheck under investigation, according to the record, predating the anonymous tip. Exhibit 6 was this Justice Department report which predates this anonymous tip. But what happens is now we have, one could argue, and we never developed the record because it wasn't necessary, that he came up clean. Nothing. Well, that causes at some point a revisitation to reasonable suspicion. We have an anonymous tip. We don't know how reliable it is. We've done nothing in 3 weeks that, okay, we're not going to tip Haycheck off. We don't want him, we'll defer to law enforcement's better judgment. At a minimum, pursue this anonymous tip. See if it's credible. See if it's reliable. Check out this other information as opposed to totally abstain from doing anything. A urinalysis, checking out the verified tip, or Agent Sealer, what do you mean you couldn't find probable cause? Tell me what evidence you do have. Does it support my original determination a month ago? Or has there been an intervening factor?
Well, Mr. Rosen, I don't think I hear you asking for a black letter rule that any time a probation agent delays his or her search due to the request of law enforcement officers, that immediately makes that person the stalking horse.
No.
You don't want that. And in fact, I can envision many times when it would be very good for a probation agent to delay the search and still not be a stalking horse for the police. So it's not all, it's, if the probation agent says, no, I'm not going to delay and goes in, clearly the probation agent has on a white hat, because there's no question he's not a stalking horse. But at some point he becomes a stalking horse. When is that point?
The trial court found when he totally abandoned, I think that was Judge Montalban's word, any legitimate, I mean, you have to understand what happened with Haycheck. He wasn't being supervised. He was out there loose. There's no direct supervision. There's essentially no indirect supervision, no urinalysis. Nothing has been done to plausibly say, we're delaying a search. They deferred it to law enforcement until law enforcement said when and if it's appropriate for them. I would submit that one of the other factors that the court considered, and it's one of these multitude of facts, is that probation was violating its own rules. And I think these are responsible, competent agents. There's an irony.
What rules were they violating?
Pardon?
What rules were they violating?
Court found one, under 80101, no record of any contacts with law enforcement. We had an expert who testified just in terms of expertise concerning a record that Agent Hamas indicated he's aware that he is to chronicle in his log all contacts that are relevant to a probationer. Clearly, these contacts with law enforcement are relevant. So he acknowledged that this was an oversight and I got busy or whatever else. No alternative to a search was considered under 80206. That the testimony said that before you do this all-invasive home invasion or search, consider what the alternatives are, like urinalysis that was requested by Hightower. But I submit to you that Agent Hamas considered law enforcement's objective. He was fearful that a urinalysis might tip Haycheck off. And he abandoned his role at that point, as the trial court found, in being a probation officer. No search plan. There was a lot of testimony as they're required under the administrative law, because this is an administrative search, they were required to do a search plan. and there was some testimony to the fact the plan amounted to who's going in the front door and who's going in the back door, not who's going to seize evidence, not how many people are in this residence, not whether these people are armed, not whether these people might be putting up resistance, not as to what the background is. It became flippant. Agent Thielen testified, well, I trusted my partner. He wouldn't send me into a dangerous situation. And I said, that was the kind of plan that was put forth at this golf course meeting for moments before the search. Who goes in the back door and who goes in the front door?
Well, what about the rule, which was in Griffin? It is preferable to have searches and seizures conducted by law enforcement authorities, but that may not always be feasible or advisable. Is that rule still in existence?
Yes. Sure. They had a search kit. I think Thomas testified, wasn't sure they brought it in. They had a search kit, ostensibly to property tag evidence, but I think prudence would dictate if you see contraband, law enforcement's there, defer to them to inventory it, if in fact they're present. What the court found was most peculiar is that, and there was testimony to support it, it's pretty unusual to call local police for backup or protection. And that by coincidence, according to this case, out-of-town Justice Department agents just happened to be there. And as the conversation is reconstructed, and again, we're left to people's credibility and memory, because we have no notes on either side of these conversations, we can't recall who asked, who should come, but basically the Justice Department went to La Crosse and said, we can't make a case against Haycheck. At which point a phone call was made to Hamas. We can't make a case. I mean, whether those are the words or he came up clean, whatever the inferences you can draw. And Hamas says, well, I'm going to do a search tomorrow. Oh, wait a second. We're here today. Well, I've got an appointment. Well, let me see if I can cancel my appointment. This is Hamas. To accommodate your presence today. It was that fact that Montalban relied on in determining who dictated the timing of the search. We're left to speculate what would have happened had Agent Thielen never called back. I guess in theory, I don't know if there would have been a search. Maybe there would have been. We're left to speculate why it was on this particular time that they decided to free Thomas from this prior rapport that no search would occur until or if we tell you it's not going to compromise our case. It leaves for another day the ultimate question, because Justice Department's position never made sense. If their goal was to get a search warrant, all they had to do is go with him on August 19th. I've already conceded, based on the record, they had reasonable suspicion. They had a verified anonymous tip. If all they're looking for, I submit it wasn't, but if all they were looking for is to get into his house to look around, just accompanying him in August, why the delay? There were all of these questions that were most troubling, in my opinion, to the trial court when it rendered this decision.
Well, why are we dealing with this as a... Just say, look, if what you tell us is right. This search violated the administrative rules that govern the parole officer. So that search is bad. And you didn't have a warrant. So that search by the law enforcement is bad. There were no exigent circumstances that will make the recovery here of invalid search. And that, why do we go to the constitutional issue? Why don't we hold the Department of Corrections to its own administrative rules and get everybody to adhere to them?
We could, and should. But what happened here, as an aside, if the goal is looking at probation and parole and not hampering their obviously difficult job, Haycheck had his probation revoked. Haycheck went to prison for these violations because, as the court knows, the exclusionary rule doesn't apply at those kinds of hearings. All of the evidence from the probation search was used to punish Mr. Haycheck. He went to prison. What we're litigating here is whether or not law enforcement through warrant avoidance. I mean, the clear preference is get a warrant. They couldn't get a warrant. I mean, it couldn't have been clear. They used as a stalking horse an ostensible probation search when months before he had abandoned that.
I would assume, maybe this is wrong, that if it's a bad administrative search because it's in violation of their rules, that they can't use this evidence to revoke probation.
Maybe he has an ineffective assistance of counsel.
Is he in jail right now?
Right.
Mr. Haychick in jail right now?
Pardon?
Is Mr. Haychick in jail right now?
No, he has served his time and has now been released on parole, and then he successfully completed
his... Is he facing criminal charges for these...
Correct. That's the issue before Montauban that we're now before you on.
How is this case different from the Flakes case where the police arrested the defendant but couldn't get his consent to search and so notified his agent and then went in on a probation search with the agent? And that was held to be okay.
Well, it was held to be okay because there, one, it was only 2 days. I mean, the time span in Flakes was only 2 days. Second of all, they got law enforcement to do probation to do what they're supposed to do. Go search if you have information of a violation. That seems to be good public policy. To get him to do his job, regardless of whether it comes from an anonymous source or from Justice Department. In this case, Justice Department, as I said, this is the only kind of case. This is a pretty narrow opportunity to address this stalking horse, whatever this illusion is to define it. It's unlikely these kinds of facts are likely to occur where all the goals of probation have been abandoned. That considering the responsibilities, they've all been abandoned. You have nobody under supervision until or if law enforcement tells you you can supposedly regain these rights. I would submit to you, as we argued in the trial court, that the logic appears of Griffin.
Now, Mr. Rosen, a few moments before, you stated that they could have gotten into the house by simply going with the probation officer, Hannes, in August, and I agree with you. But on the other hand, I'm not so persuaded by your argument because it seems to me there would be many times when law enforcement officers would have a legitimate reason to not want to go in August. Maybe they're looking for bigger fish to fry. Maybe they're looking for more for evidence of a more serious crime or of other crimes. So that by itself doesn't persuade me.
In terms of their not going earlier?
Yeah. There could be many legitimate law enforcement reasons not to go earlier.
There are not many legitimate probation and parole interests. And that's...
I'm sorry, there are not many
legitimate probation and parole stated interests that would justify that delay. To increase the punishment, to get him dirtier than he might be when you're there, you have obligations to the community for safety. God forbid what would have happened in that five-week period. Somebody died of a drug overdose. That would be the next case up here, as to why the agent didn't do what he was mandated to do. I was trying to fry bigger fish. I mean, at some point they part. Law enforcement clearly has an interest in waiting, developing the best case they can, or whatever their strategy was. Probation. And at a minimum, a year analysis is ordered. And it went to Hamas, who wasn't even Haychick's probation agent. He took it because, I forget what the phrase was, but the gist of it in the record would speak better because it looked like this. There are going to be some names he knows in this case.
But if the probation officer calls him in for a year analysis, people are going to be running out of that house like rabbits when he informs them that he's going downtown to give a year analysis.
In theory, you should be doing that all the time. I mean, I don't know what... I mean, he signs rules of probation that indicates his consent to these kinds of year analysis. Well, then do it. I mean, I don't see why they would tip somebody off that you agreed to provide a year analysis, now they're asking for it.
Well, is that what his rules provided? What level of supervision was he on?
I'm sorry?
What level of supervision was he on? Was he required by the conditions of probation or the rules of his supervision to submit to regularly scheduled year analysis? Or,
no.
I mean, the impression I was under from the record was that the order for the year analysis was definitely going to tip the hand. Like, that's why they didn't pursue it.
I'm not sure why they didn't pursue it. I mean, I guess I do know why they didn't pursue it. Hamas was concerned it would compromise right. law enforcement's interests.
I mean, I think that was specifically testified
Correct.
To. And it sounds to me, based on what you just said, that you really are asking for a rule that would stand for the proposition that any delay means you lose your search. So if you've got your reasonable suspicion or your reasonable grounds to do your probation search, you better use it or lose it. I mean, that's basically what you're proposing here.
Provided, again, the trial court found there was an abandonment, and I don't think of any legitimate probation objective did he abandon his role as a probation officer as a minimum. I don't know what their explanation is. Why weren't you supervising? Okay, I understand that we may want, you have a responsibility to the public, protect the public safety. Besides, you have a responsibility to Mr. Hacek. And maybe the your analysis, in theory, the inference would be it might tip off that there's another investigation going on. Why not supervise them? That, to supervise them. That seems to be a pretty low water mark.
What do you mean when you say by that? When you say, why not supervise him? What do you mean by that?
Contact him. Verify, how are you doing? How's your job? You're something. No contact. When asked the question on cross-examination, Agent Hamas, I believe, indicated he did nothing. And that was the crux and the basis of the court's decision that at that point he had abandoned any plausible, credible, because these were credibility findings, any credible claim that you're acting as a probation agent.
Does the record reflect anything about the sort of probation that he was on, or as I indicated a moment ago, what level of supervision he was on, whether he was in, I think it reflects that he was at the end of his probationary
right.
term, was he not? And so
yeah.
he probably had a monthly call-in to his agent at this point, right?
Yes.
And so the 3 weeks of no contact may not have been at all out of the ordinary and doesn't necessarily stand for the proposition that the agent abandoned supervision.
It wasn't 3 weeks. We went, the tip came in August 19th. The search is September 24th. I understand it's in the state's interest to make that window as small as possible. It's in our interest to make it as large as possible.
But wasn't there a week delay in the verification? So we really are talking 3 weeks?
Well, again, we're left to reconstructing fax headers when fax, because nobody's got reports of anything concerning this.
Do they usually have reports?
Yes. And in fact, I think the expert testified, when asked, his biggest criticism of when he was director of corrections, his biggest criticism of the agency is he spent too much time documenting every single contact, but those were the rules. I would ask the court to find probation agents do have the right to search. But when they abandon their rights and responsibilities to Hacek, to the community, whether he's a danger, or any kind of supervision, the only way Griffin applied was to give agents an opportunity to enforce compliance, to create deterrence, public safety. None of those apply. In hindsight, one could argue, we aren't, you wait 5 weeks, what is the argument why you shouldn't go to and get a warrant? Too cumbersome? Time-consuming? You've got 5 weeks, you're not doing anything. You're not supervising. Go to a judge. All of the rationale for expediency is no longer applies.
At the hearing, or is there a record of testimony that Hamas did not supervise because he was deferring to the criminal investigation? Was there that kind of evidence?
There was the testimony he didn't want to do anything that might tip off, I think was the phrase, Mr. Hacek, there was an ongoing investigation, anything. Whether the inference is he wasn't going to do anything about supervising, that's my conclusion.
You know, the thing that I'm trying to balance in my own head is this. On the one hand, we want the probation officer to do his or her job, which is to check on this person, try and prevent further crime by this person, get him on the right road. That's a public protection, too. On the other hand, one of the errors in the criminal justice system is that each of the component parts puts up walls. They don't talk to each other. They don't cooperate. And the result is that it's not very good for the public safety sometimes. and so that corrections ought to be in touch with the police. And the police ought to be in touch with corrections about people that are in the community that they know about, that have committed certain crimes, so that they're aware of that for protection of the community. And then we get to this kind of case where they do work together, and then the question is, did they do right? That is, are we going to allow not only a probation revocation, as we pointed out, but now, in effect, using that evidence for a warrant and getting additional evidence for another criminal offense. So how do you get around this? It's maybe this case, from your perspective, is easy because you have a request by the police to lay off. They do lay off. For whether it's 3 weeks, 4 weeks, or 5 weeks, he is not doing what is expected under probation. And according to the trial judge, that just ends that. Now he is a tool of the police. This is operating under their rules, not his. But anything short of that, any communication short of that, is that going to also mean that he's the stalking horse?
No, I mean, it's a balancing test. It's sort of, how are you going to describe a stalking horse? I can't describe it. I know it when I'll see it. Montauban saw it. Court of Appeals saw it. It's a balancing test between cooperation, as you talked about in Flakes, and abdication. Abdicating all the responsibilities of an agent. And I would submit it's the latter. Thank you.
So abdication is the descriptive word. Thank you, Mr. Rosen. Ms. Nashold?
Okay, first of all, back to the 3 weeks. It was 3 weeks, not 5 weeks. Agent Hammies received the file August 28th, on or about August 28th. The trial court makes that clear in its findings. Also, on August 27th, all they had was an anonymous tip. High Attire faxed the information the La Crosse Police Department in order to verify the anonymous tip on August 27th. The trial court spells that out. Now, I think Justice Sykes is correct that what the defense's position is that if you've got the information, if you've got reasonable grounds to conduct a probation search, you must do so immediately. He's essentially requiring probation agents to compromise law enforcement. He says, well, there was no supervision done, but anything that would have been done would have tipped off the defendant in this case that he was being investigated. He was under minimal supervision. My understanding is that he was supposed to call in on a monthly basis or something. If he receives a call out of the blue from his probation agent saying, hi, how's it going? Is your urine dirty? This is going to tip him off. And 3 weeks is a reasonable amount of time to delay a lawful probation search. And also that 3 weeks can cut in the state's favor in this case too, because when the contact initially takes place between law enforcement and probation, Hammies is informed, look, we're picking garbage. We're trying to find probable cause on this guy. And he could have said, well, forget your garbage pick. Come along with me. I'm going to do a probation search. But he doesn't. He lets law enforcement pursue its investigation.
So I sit here just, wow. I'm asking, well, is it a probation search? Yeah, in many ways you can say it was. Is it a police search? Yeah, in many ways you can say it was. I don't even know if the scales tip at all. But if they don't tip, you lose, right? Isn't the burden of proof upon you to show by clear and convincing evidence that this was a probation search?
Yes, although this was... Yes, it is the state's burden to show that this was a lawful search. However, this was a search conducted by probation. So I don't know exactly how that factors into the balance, but everyone admits that this was conducted by probation agents, and then the question is, well, are they just stalking horses? And so I think that the burdens are maybe a little more complicated in a case like this than in a lot of other Fourth Amendment cases. As I was stating, this three-week period, the fact that Hamis could have said to law enforcement at that point, if he really was just interested in being a subterfuge for law enforcement, he could have said, well, then just come with me and we'll forget your own investigation. This shows that they had independence from each other, that they didn't impermissibly collude with each other in order to escape Fourth Amendment requirements. I also say
to explain the fact that they violated their own rules. There was obviously a number of contacts between them, but that was neither the officers nor Mr. Hamis had it down in writing.
Well, first of all, a violation of administrative rules doesn't necessarily result in a constitutional violation, but I don't even think that it has been established that there was a violation. 80101 says an agent's investigation should be thorough, objective, and well-documented. And I don't think that it's as strict as defense is stating it is, in that you have to document every single contact you have with every single person in a case, no matter how collateral you view them. And Hamis clearly testified that he viewed this as collateral to the defendant's probation. He said that he has not documented every contact he's had with people who he considers collaterals in the past, and that's what took place here. He said, yeah, I should have, but at best this is just perhaps poor work habits. It's not a violation of the code, and it certainly isn't a constitutional violation.
Now, the testimony of the expert that was referred to by opposing counsel takes a contrary view, and the expert testified, at least in the record, that in his opinion, this would have been a violation. I mean, that, as I recall reading the record.
He states that that his understanding is that they keep records to a fault, and I don't think he specifically says that they keep every single contact to a fault, but that he's concerned that they're pushing paper too much instead of getting out there and dealing with the probationers. And I think that it is ambiguous in the record as to whether this was an actual violation. And there are times when Professor Dickey states his opinion on whether a rule was violated, or even on the ultimate issue of whether it was a probation search, he ultimately says, well, I could be wrong. And then I think defense counsel says something like, well, that's why you don't ask the last question, because that was his answer to the last question asked by defense counsel. And he says, you know, I can't get into everybody's heads, and I could be wrong.
What was the purpose of this search, of the probationer being searched? By the probationer doing this search, what was his purpose?
He wanted to find out whether there was a violation occurring, whether this probationer was again involved in dealing or using drugs, and he hoped to find evidence.
Mm-hmm. Which was the same purpose as the police, was it?
That's right, and the same was true in Flakes, that they had the same basic objective, and that's going to happen a lot. There's going to be overlap in what the purpose of both the probation agent and law enforcement is in regards to it's either going to be a violation for the probation agent, or it's going to be a crime if you're in law enforcement. And as pointed out in Flakes, it was the same officer who could not gain consensual entry into the home who tipped off the probation agent that this guy was violating. And I say that three-week period is really determinative in this case, because if you look at the other case law cited by the parties, many of the factors that take place here are present in those other cases, including Griffin and Flakes. And what it keeps coming down to is he didn't do anything for 3 weeks. That's not an abandonment of probation goals. That was a postponement of doing what he could have done, but that does not mean that it was an abandonment or that he failed to act as a probation agent. He had that intention from the outset to do the probation search, and he ultimately did it. This was just a situation where both law enforcement and probation pursued their own objectives in a way that was completely lawful, and there was nothing untoward or improper about what they did.
Thank you, Ms. Nashel. Thank you, Mr. Wilson. That concludes 98-3485 CR, and we are adjourned until our November sitting.